This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Even as some grudgingly admit to the reality of climate change, many believe that the impact of that change on humans is years in our future. Think again. There are already societies around the globe who are altering patterns of behavior and customs that have been part of their culture for millennia. Consider them the canaries in the coal mine. Social scientists are joining their hard science colleagues in studying the impact of a warming planet on societies, while others are working to raise awareness in an effort to stop global climate change. We talk about both this hour. Harvard Ayers is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Appalachian State University and the author of Arctic Gardens, Voices from an Abundant Land, a book which outlines what he observes among the native populations of Alaska and how they are coping with climate change. He's also part of a network of activists working on climate convergence on Raleigh. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Good to see you. And joining us by phone is Robin Smith, an attorney and former Assistant Secretary for Environment at the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. She joins us by phone. Welcome back. Welcome to the program as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Ayers, although you're an anthropologist, your other book, An Appalachian Tragedy, about which you were on several years ago on this program, is also kind of about the same topic. It's about pollution and tree death and how that is impacting folks close to us in our listening area. I know that has a human impact, but do you see a connection between that book and your latest book?
I see an amazing connection, Mike. It really is, because you look at what people live in the Arctic, where they want to do a lot of petroleum exploration and so forth, and where actually global warming is at its worst. There's been like a 7-degree Fahrenheit increase in winter temperatures over the last 60 years. But anyhow, the people up there don't have a whole lot of political power because they're out in the middle of nowhere. Then you look in Appalachia, especially in southern West Virginia, and you see the same thing. The mountain people there have very little control because basically King Coal rules in West Virginia. So in both cases, pollution coming from outside that area and some within has impacted both of these areas. So there's your connection.
You know, how cold does it get in Barrow, Alaska, where you spent much of your time for this book? How cold does it get there in the deepest, darkest of winter?
I would say in those days when there is no light, right, for months at a time, they don't see the sun. You're talking about temperatures well below minus 50. And just one little anecdote here is that my wife asked the people up in Barrow. She went up with me last summer to Barrow. She asked one of the students there that goes to high school, when do you not go to school? How cold does it have to get? And he said, if the temperature is minus 40 Fahrenheit or below, we will not go to school. And then we have that a lot of times.
So when it's minus 40 or minus 50, what difference does a 7-degree rise in temperature make?
Well,
below freezing.
It used to be minus 50, minus 60. I mean, we're talking about a major difference here. And what happens then is that we have melting of the permafrost. And even more importantly, melting of the ice on the Arctic Ocean.
Even at those temperatures?
Well, not at those temperatures, but that's part of the year. And the whole yearly cycle involves, and of course, permafrost is usually just a little bit under the surface and everything's frozen from there down.
So it makes sense for a professor from App State to write about the death of trees in the Appalachian Mountains and the impact of that on society. How did you become interested in what's going on in Alaska?
Well, I know that for 2,000 to 3,000 years, the Eskimo people, in this case called the Inupiat Eskimos of northern Alaska, have been predominantly whalers. They've caught a big whale that gets up to 50 feet or more long. And this whale called the bowhead has been the center of their culture, their religion, their social organization, their subsistence, i.e. their food getting practices, are all centered around the idea of this particular whale. And then this whale is going to be impacted possibly by oil well drilling. It's already being impacted by the thawing of the Arctic Ocean in terms of where it goes when it migrates by Barrow.
How big is that whale, did you say?
They can be roughly 50 to 60 feet long. That's a little big. I mean, they're kind of tough by that age. But for each foot, you can figure a ton.
And that is how they live. That's how they've fed themselves for years, because that will last a long time.
Right, and keep in mind that these Stone Age people went out in things they call umiaks. We call them canoes. There's their sealskin-covered frame. And they went after this 50-ton monster. I mean, it's almost like David and Goliath.
I want to talk about the fact that these people, these native peoples that you talked to for the course of this book and studied their culture and the impact of climate change on their culture, you say that they are the closest, they live the closest to the way Native American peoples lived when they first arrived on the continent. Not much has changed, correct?
Well, I'd say a good bit.
They do have modern conveniences now.
Yes.
But still their traditions hold true.
Well, certainly the way that they get their food, the way that their religion is structured, is still structured around the whale.
So if you're sitting up in Barrow, Alaska, and you're one of these Eskimos, the climate change seems very alarming. Robin Smith, I know that you worked in the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, and we know also that the environment in the lower 48 is a hard sell for some people. Do we have any examples in this part of the world of climate change being as alarming as it must be in that part of the world?
You know, I don't know if I would describe it as alarming yet, but I think we are seeing ways in which people are starting to acknowledge it and adapt to it. And actually, my favorite example is that the USDA has revised its temperature zones for the United States. So those temperature zone maps that you see in your seed catalogs and your gardening magazines that tell you, and agricultural publications that tell you, you know, what the range is for different types of plants and when you can plant and, you know, how late you should wait given where you are in the United States. Those maps have changed as of, I think it's 2010, 2011, to recognize the fact that temperature zones are changing and there are plants that are migrating northward from some of the more southern parts of the United States as the temperature, rises and the growing season lengthens.
Of course, some of us don't like winter, so that's nice when we have more time for plants and flowers and warmer temperatures, but they come with consequences that are not good. Correct?
Well, that can be very true, and you know, one of the unknowns is, as you think about an accelerating rise in temperature, plants can adapt as long as the changes occur slowly. But rapid change can be extremely disruptive for both plants and animals, and I think that's one of the great concerns, is that as the pace picks up, will it continue to be the case that plants and animals can adjust without major disruption in the ecosystem, in our agricultural system? And then there's the separate issue of sea level rise and how you adapt in terms of development in coastal areas as that rise in temperature may also cause sea level to rise and encroach on coastal real estate.
Was I right, Doctor, in calling these people in Alaska that you studied, the canaries in the coal mine?
There's no question, because they've had roughly three to four times the warming we have here.
Why?
Well, that's a pretty technical meteorological phenomenon.
And you're not a natural scientist.
Has to do with atmospheric circulation, but when I get past the second page of any Scientific American article, I have a hard time.
Break. you looked at two different populations up there that you originally thought would probably not have much in common, given the fact that one has their society built on whaling, which you talked a little bit about, and the other they base their population or their lifestyle on the migration of caribou. But you found out that they, in fact, do have a lot in common. Talk about that.
Well, the things they have in common is that this amount of global warming has changed many things in both places. And so that the whales are having a difficult time of it, perhaps, or at least aren't in the same places where the people can get them. Whereas the caribou, it's warming up and certain bugs aren't killed off in the winter and their migration patterns are different. So both of their major animals, and by the way, the Indian people called the Gwich'in, who hunt the caribou, they feel that half their heart is caribou. Half their heart is human. And caribous have the same thing. So they feel like a brother to the caribou, and the same kind of thing is present with the whale.
And yet they do hunt and kill these and eat these animals, right?
And they certainly ask their permission and see the caribou as part of the plan, the general plan.
You wrote in your book about a young boy who went out for – he was allowed finally at the age of 13 to go out and join the hunt for the caribou, and he got one on his first time out. And it was almost as though, the way you write it, he felt that the caribou presented itself to him and allowed him to kill it.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's the way that the Eskimos see the whale.
So
it's very, very similar.
Now, the whales obviously are seeking out colder water, so they're getting farther away from Alaska, so they can't be hunted quite as easily. But the caribou are on land. It seems to me that you can still follow the caribou. So how big an impact is
it? Here's the problem. Now, this is going to be counterintuitive. It's getting warmer, but it's snowing more. In very, very cold weather, where the caribou migrate up to the coast, up to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the air is normally so cold that there won't be much moisture in it. But as you drop, or as you go up in temperature, then you're going to get more snow. And this is very difficult on the caribou because it's an additional stressor that they have to go through to get to their preferred birthing ground, which is the Arctic Refuge.
Mm. How long ago did these societies in Alaska, and these are the northernmost stretches of Alaska, I take it, how long ago did they start noticing things were changing?
The way that I got it from them, it was probably in the latter half of the 20th century, so say 1960, 1970, they started seeing some of the changes.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
When did we first notice that they were noticing changes? When did we become aware of it?
Well, you know, I kind of have a hard time saying because, you know, they're kind of isolated up there. And I've been at this for 10 years, but it was before that, I know for sure, as these folks have told me.
Because we've been hearing stories now, and I'm sure, Robin, you can, as a former member of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, you also were very aware of melting glaciers and melting polar ice caps. And we've heard stories of rivers that have been traditionally frozen over in the wintertime not being frozen anymore. I remember growing up in the D.C. area and looking down the under the 14th Street Bridge crossing into Washington in February and seeing that it was frozen over. It doesn't do that anymore. It doesn't freeze over anymore. And you're talking about up there in Alaska, the thawing permafrost. Why is that of concern? You mentioned in your book, for instance, that the thawing permafrost makes it easier to dig a grave. So why is that a bad thing?
Well, it does, because it's not frozen.
And they don't have to use jackhammers.
Down. Well, they still have to use jackhammers, but not as much.
Okay.
I was in on that grave digging when, unfortunately, some relative of the person I was staying with passed away. But here's the problem with melting permafrost. Permafrost is like a bank or a storage facility for both methane, which is very similar to CO2 in that it's a greenhouse gas, and CO2. So when you melt it, all this thousands, maybe even millions of years old stuff that's been frozen for a long, long time thaws, it's going to give off those global warming gases. So the warmer it gets,
the warmer it gets, and
it's what we call a positive feedback cycle. I mean, warm one, it warms the other part, and it comes back as a double whammy.
Dr. Harvard Ayers is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Appalachian State University. Robin Smith is the former member of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Tally, including wealth management and tax planning attorneys for individuals and businesses advising clients on asset preservation, estate planning, and wealth building strategies. Horak Tally, attorneys who get things done. And North Carolina Dance Theater's Contemporary Fusion, featuring three ballets, including the Golden Section by Tony Award-winning choreographer Twyla Tharp, April 25th through 27th at the Knight Theater. Tickets at ncdance.org. Monday on Charlotte Talks, Pat McCrory has been governor of North Carolina for just over 3 months. His early decisions have pleased some people and disappointed others. He's given cabinet appointees substantial raises over their predecessors, repealed an executive order signed by his predecessor, and weighed in on Charlotte trolley and stadium upgrades for the Panthers. A panel of experts will help us analyze Pat McCrory's first 100 days. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama offers his 2014 budget plan. The Senate appears set to debate gun control legislation, and the Postal Service will continue Saturday delivery.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for that discussion this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the changing climate and how it's beginning to affect human society. And a case study is that which was conducted by one of our guests today, Dr. Harvard Ayers, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at App State University. He's the author of An Appalachian Tragedy, also his most recent book, Arctic Gardens, Voices from an Abundant Land, which is about what we're talking about, the Eskimo populations in the northernmost parts of Alaska really already being impacted by climate change. Joining us by phone, Robin Smith, environmental attorney and former Assistant Secretary for the Environment for the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. There's a passage from your book that I'd like you to read. Darius Elias, he is an Eskimo that you met. He's highly educated. He went away. His grandmother sent him away to be educated so she could come back. He could come back and bring that knowledge to the tribe. And you spent a lot of time talking to him. That's part of the book that where he talks about the changes he's witnessed. If you'd read that for us.
Yes, I'm glad to, Mike. Let me just say first that Darius has become a good friend and been part of some organizations that we formed to try to stop the drilling that might occur in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where the caribou that they hunt actually has their babies. And here's what he said about the changes that he's seen from global warming. Some elders have told me that Mother Earth is trying to cleanse herself from the destruction that humans have caused. It is like the immune system has kicked in. I have seen it around here, and it is just as simple as walking on the clear ice. About 12 years ago, I was walking with an elder, Erwin Linklater. He stuck a stick down a muskrat hole, that's a hole in the ice, and pushed it down once. Then he pushed it down again and said, As he pulled it back up, he said that he had done that since he was a kid, and he could maybe push it down 2 inches at the bottom of the lake. Now there was a foot and a half of mud on that pole. The wood frogs that used to be very plentiful in the lakes behind Old Crow, which is the community that Darius lives in, are not so plentiful. The caribou migrations have changed. The caribou patterns have changed. And we're seeing a lot more parasites on the caribou. And we are seeing insects we have not seen before. Also, there are pelicans arriving. The vegetation is growing up the side of the mountains. On the coastal plain, the dwarf birches are just invading from the mountains at a very rapid rate, which is also alarming. The weather patterns are especially noticeable. We see summer clouds in December, the fluffy clouds. It rains in December and causes havoc amongst the animal population. The cycles are not as consistent as they used to be. It doesn't get to 50 or 60 below anymore. It's to the point where it is costing people their lives. My grandmother and an elder were walking across a stretch of river that they have walked across the same weekend their entire lives to go fish. She fell through and drowned. We had to find her underneath the ice. Luckily, we found her. That same stretch of ice, for 70 years, they trusted it, and now we can't do that anymore. When we go out in the bush, we don't know if we're going to encounter an overflow or an open lake, so people are hesitant to go out. If so, they have to go with a group of people to make sure that they are safe. Things are changing everywhere.
Wow. That's a pretty dramatic painting of the picture of what's going on up there. Robin, is there anything in North Carolina that has changed that dramatically in terms of changing topography, aside from the plant, the temperature ranges for plants? Is there anything you can point to in North Carolina where things have changed that dramatically?
You know, I'm not sure things have changed quite that dramatically yet. I do think the place we're likely to see it first and may be seeing some early effects is at the coast because of sea level rise. And you know, we have some areas of the coast, the entire east coast of the United States is a region that is more vulnerable to sea level rise than certain other parts of the world. It's not something that happens uniformly, just like temperature change doesn't happen uniformly. So North Carolina has a vulnerable shoreline, and the northern part of our coast is particularly vulnerable because we've got a combination of sea level rise and the land is sinking to some extent for a variety of reasons. So you put those two things together and you have a higher risk of flooding of land further inland than we may have seen it in hundreds of years.
You were with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources for how long?
I was there for about 12 years.
Okay, a pretty long time. And I know that this is just part of the job of somebody in that department. This is only a little sliver of it. But 98% of scientists say the climate is changing. How many of them agree that human activity, including the burning of fossil fuels, is causing it? Robin, from your experience.
Well, I've seen the same surveys that are cited most often in the media, which surveys of climate scientists, I think you usually do get a 98%, 97% response number agreeing that there's some human contribution to climate change. And I think the data certainly suggests that human activity has accelerated the greenhouse effect or enhance the greenhouse mm-hmm. effect. The data looks pretty strong on that.
At first politicians would say, scientists don't agree. And then somehow it came out that 98% of scientists do agree that the climate is changing. But what's the situation, Doctor, with people agreeing that we have something to do with it, and it's not just part of the natural cycle of the Earth, because the Earth has been hotter and warmer in the past?
Well, I would say, Mike, that it's pretty much the same percentage as say that the Earth is warming. I'd say 97-98% of scientists say not that just that humans are contributing, but we are the major cause of climate change. And I don't know of any scientists in the universities I'm aware of who do not believe that.
And yet we still hear in the media people saying that that's not the case. Are they just deliberately denying this for economic reasons or because they simply don't believe it? I mean, why are they so, if the word is correct, obtuse?
Well, that's a good question. And we call them the deniers because they deny the scientific fact. The fact is that the science is settled. So what there's a few scientists that will go along with not questioning that global warming's happening, but questioning whether humans had anything to do with it. Because if we didn't, then we don't need to make any changes. And these are mostly people, scientists, who are in the hire of Exxon or of Duke Power or one of the organizations that tends to benefit from burning fossil fuels.
So if fossil fuels is in fact the cause of this, the drilling of oil is not necessarily a problem until you burn the oil, convert it to gasoline or diesel fuel, and then burn it in an engine. But nonetheless, there are environmental problems associated if something happens at the drilling location or along the pipelines that pipe it. The whaling natives that you talked about in Alaska are torn over the presence of Shell oil drilling in the ocean right off their coastline. For one reason, they get royalties from the oil being pumped out of there, so they're getting some economic benefit. On the other hand, it's a spill would devastate their ability to go whaling. So what about those who have a caribou hunting tradition? Do they face the same things with pipelines on land or with drilling on land?
Well, they would if there were drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's the place where the Porcupine caribou herd, named after a river by that name, that's where the Indians' caribou have their bed. They'll drop 30,000 babies every year very near or in this Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which has been a target for drilling for a long time. And there would certainly be pipelines going all over the place up there.
And spills do occur, even on pipelines, correct?
Oh, yes. We have many examples like the Alaska pipeline. It goes from Prudhoe Bay down to Valdez, where they had the famous Exxon Valdez spill some years ago. That has spilled out a lot of oil over the years.
normally when we talk about this, we have a natural scientist on the program, an environmental scientist. But you are, as I've said many times, an anthropologist. One physicist has said that he believes that 90% of research on global change will have to be done by social scientists such as yourself. He says that while natural scientists can advise policymakers of the technological solutions, it is social scientists who will have to figure out how to bring about the massive economic and social transformation on a very tight deadline. Now, there was an article in, I think, the New York Times this morning about a NASA scientist who has spent a lot of time clamoring about the environment and the damage we've been doing to the environment. He's retiring so that he can testify against the government, because NASA scientists work for the government and can't testify against them, because he says the problem is urgent. How urgent do you see this problem as being?
Well, I'm guessing that this is Dr. James Hansen that you're speaking of, sir. Yes, it is, as I thought. I think the problem is urgent enough that I plan to spend the rest of my active life, my activist life, which may be 10, 20 years, doing nothing but this. This is so urgent, and it's going to have tremendous effects on human beings, and I'm very glad to hear that said.
Is that how the people in the government, when you were in the government, Robin, the government of North Carolina, is that how they viewed this, or were they more relaxed about it?
Well, you know, I think we've really seen a change over the last few years. I think there was a period going back about 5 years ago when there was a lot of interest in the state legislature in climate change, and there was a legislative study commission looking at climate change. There were a number of pieces of legislation, like the legislation that required a certain amount of electricity to be generated by renewable energy sources, and affected the major utilities like Duke and Progress Energy in the state. That happened around the same time. So there was sort of a high level of interest around 2006, 2007, 2008. In recent years, with changes in the leadership at the legislature and more recently in the governor's office, the Legislative Study Committee on Climate Change was allowed to die a natural death. I think it always had a time limit on it. It wasn't renewed. There's actually been a bill introduced this session to repeal that renewable energy goal for the state. So we seem to be moving back. There seems to be a real pushback in the state legislature.
Who is behind the repealing of that 2007 piece of legislation that required renewable energy resources to be investigated or used by utilities and things like that?
I believe the person who was the primary sponsor of the bill is Representative Mike Hager, but there are a number of other co-sponsors.
What would the impact of that repeal be? If they were successful in repealing it, how would we feel it? How would we notice it?
I mean, immediately what you would notice is that you would no longer be seeing a very small fee on your electric bill if you're getting your electricity from Duke or from Progress Energy for renewable energy and energy conservation measures. What the law currently requires is that those two companies, along with some of the major municipal utilities and co-ops, meet a certain percentage of their electric power generation using renewable sources like solar and wind, and there are a number of different things they can use, and energy conservation. By 2000, I believe the ultimate date was 2021, was the final deadline for meeting their goals for renewable energy use. And so that requirement would go away, and Progress, Duke, the other electric utilities who were affected by that law would no longer be under any obligation to meet some of their power generation with renewable sources or energy conservation measures.
And what has been the burden, if there has been a burden, on the legislation as it now stands. In other words, we're paying a little bit of money extra if we get our energy from Duke Energy or Progress Energy, which is almost one of the same company now. But for the companies themselves, has it been difficult for them to operate or more substantially more expensive for them to operate with that law in place?
Actually, no. And the fees themselves are very, very small. I think the two companies, they were two companies when all this started. They are now one. But they have to demonstrate to the State Utilities Commission what their actual costs are for using this renewable energy or for meeting these energy conservation goals. And I believe the last figures I saw is for an average Duke Power residential customer, that was amounting to 21 cents per month on their
utility. So what is what's the rationale behind taking even a small little thing that might move us closer to causing less damage to the environment? A small little thing. What's the rationale behind that? You want to take that, Dr. Ayers?
Yes, I certainly would. I agree very much with Robin that Duke and used to be CP&L, now Progress, and now Duke, basically, that they're behind all of this legislation that would wipe out any thoughts of a renewable standard for the state. And what they want to do is to go to very expensive nuclear and to coal and to natural gas. But the problem there is that if you take all the oil and gas in the world and you burn it one way or another, whether it's to make electricity, to power cars or whatever, you're not going to equal to the potential for burning coal in terms of its contribution. I mean, it is the 900-pound gorilla in the room, yet this is what Duke Power wants to do.
And to be fair about this, if you put solar and wind into the equation, and maybe geothermal where it's appropriate, because it's not appropriate everywhere on the planet, that's only a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of what we produce and use today using traditional methods. You're saying I'm wrong?
I'm saying that North Carolina has the potential to produce all the electricity it needs in offshore wind. Now, would that be a tremendous capital investment? Of course.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to set up all these windmills out several miles. But even taking out the areas that would affect tourism, the areas that are particularly sensitive in terms of environmental or military use, you still have more than enough power out there from something that is completely benign. We have the greatest offshore wind resources on the East Coast.
We've done a program on this, and scientists say that if you want to throw a dart at the map where it would be the best place to put windmills, it would be right off our coastline. We are perfectly situated. So, Robin, I'm sure you know this. Why would anybody want to fight this? Why wouldn't they want to take advantage of it?
Well, you know, I think certainly the justification that's been offered at the legislature is that it's an unnecessary cost to consumers. I think if you look at the actual figures, it's been a tiny cost to consumers, and actually the costs have been coming down as each year has gone along.
Robin Smith is the former member of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, presenting the new 2013 Subaru models, including the XV Crosstrek, an all-wheel drive crossover built for all-terrain and fuel efficiency. More information at TyndallSubaru.com. And CPCC Arts presenting Fences, today through the 21st, and Dialogues of the Carmelites, today through Sunday, a part of Sensoria. Details at tics.cpcc.edu. Today is the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock is the Domestic Hour. President Barack Obama offers his 2014 budget plan. The Senate clears the way to the debate control legislation. And the U.S. Postal Service will continue Saturday delivery. A panel of journalists will join Diane for analysis of those top stories. And at 11 o'clock, it's the International Hour. Join the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon today here on 90.7 WFAE.
Hey, this is Peter Sagal, and I was wondering, you know, if you're not doing anything on May 2nd, would you like to go to the movies and see our show? Because we'll be simulcasting Wait Wait Live from New York City to theaters all over the country, and I thought it'd be, you know, fun if you could come. Maybe we'll get a soda after, if that's okay. That's Wait, Wait, live in theaters on May 2nd.
Join WFAE at the AMC Concord Mills and Stonecrest at Piper Glen. Visit WFAE.org for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about climate change and the warming of the climate and how it is impacting people already, particularly in the northern stretches of the globe around Alaska, which is the area that Dr. Harvard Ayers, one of our guests, has studied up around DeBarrow, Alaska. He's Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Appalachian State University and author of Arctic Gardens, Voices from an Abundant Land. Robin Smith joins us by phone. She's an environmental attorney and a former assistant Secretary for the Environment at the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. We spent some time talking about renewable energy and an attempt to repeal a requirement that Duke Energy devote some of their resources to renewable energy. And I asked who was pushing that. And Robin, you wanted to make clear that it's not clear at all that Duke Energy is pushing that, despite Dr. Ayers' assertion.
I just don't know that. I know, you know, who has signed on to the bill at the state legislature, but Duke had actually been very supportive of renewable energy diversification at the time the state law was originally adopted. I think since then they and the other utilities have had some challenges in terms of meeting goals, not the general goals for renewable energy, but there were some specific set-asides for energy generated by animal waste. And those have turned out to be difficult because the technology has been difficult. So I know the utility companies have felt they needed a little leeway in terms of types of renewables. I haven't seen an indication that they were really pushing back on the general goal for renewables and energy efficiency.
And you disagree with that?
I disagree heartily with that. I mean, let's look at it this way and just look at it logically. The guy who is now governor of North Carolina, of course, was mayor here in Charlotte for a while, was a longtime employee of Duke Energy. And so, and a lot of these people who are now, and the governor has wiped out a lot of committees that had people who were concerned about global warming and other things and wanted renewables. He took them off these task forces and put on Duke people, basically.
You've already said that in your retirement you're becoming an activist for this cause because of what you discovered in Alaska. And I know that you're part of an effort to drive the realities of climate change home to Raleigh, literally, because you're driving to Raleigh or walking. I don't know how you're getting there, but you're trying to keep climate change down. You should be walking. It's called Climate Convergence. What is climate convergence?
In this case, we're talking about converging in the sense of people coming from different directions to Raleigh to talk about the threat, the grave threat that is climate change. Where some of us are riding bicycles. I'm going to leave Boone in a couple of weeks on my bike, riding with some of the ASU students down to Wilkesboro and Winston-Salem, where we'll have a little rally on a Thursday, that's the 18th of April. And then on the 19th, we bike on to Greensboro, where we have another little rally. And then on Saturday and Sunday, we're going to do an educational thing on Saturday and a big rally on Sunday in the main Halifax Mall in Raleigh.
And the whole point is to get legislators and government officials to do something to stop climate change. That's an admirable goal. Is it possible, even if we are responsible for it as human beings, and the United States, if we are responsible for it because of fossil fuel, we consume more fossil fuel per capita than anybody, and China's catching up quickly. But how can we stop it? Because we have, really, at the moment, no alternatives unless we want to go back to the 19th century.
Well, the alternatives are wind and solar. And wind can power your car just as certainly as oil can power your car.
Through electricity?
Through electricity, exactly.
But electric cars have not, despite all the hoopla, and despite the fact that we are sitting directly across the street now from a charging station in a parking lot, which has been there for several years, and I've been here every morning for several years, and I've seen exactly one car one time plugged into that charging station. They're not catching on.
Well, there have not been many of them made at all. They've just recently, and Toyota hasn't made one.
Too expensive.
And the ones that are made are too expensive. They're $40,000. What we've got to have is a Volkswagen, a people's car, that actually can be charged up at night. I drive a Prius, but you can't do that. You just have to, it has some electric facility, and there have been a lot of those sold. I think they're pretty popular.
This is a state effort. You're lobbying in Raleigh, but this is not a state problem. This is not even a United States problem. This is a global problem. How do you marshal the forces of all of the political entities that exist in the world today and all of the corporations who are profiting mightily from our way of life today? How do you marshal all of that and make a dent in any of it?
Well, the fact is we haven't yet. And the political part is the problem. There's no doubt that it's happening. There's no doubt scientifically that it's going to bring the world to a very bad place if we burn all the oil and gas and coal that we can. So somewhere along the line, somebody has to rise and say, we're not going to let this happen anymore, that's in a position of power, which I'm not, obviously.
You're not a natural scientist, so I'm not going to ask you why the northern climes are experiencing the most noticeable and most dramatic changes. But do you know, if because they are the canary in the coal mine up there, that if that will filter down toward the equator and up from the Antarctic toward their equator in the southern hemisphere over time? Are we going to see this quickly converging on the equatorial regions?
Every report that comes in from scientists changes the models to seeing that it's going to happen more quickly than we thought the last time that we got data. And if we go up approximately 2 degrees centigrade, this is what the scientists tell us on the international bodies, if we go up 2 degrees centigrade, then we're going to have very serious disruption. And already they're having that in Alaska. They're having serious disruption. If we burn all the coal and all the oil, we'll go 4 or 5 degrees centigrade, and that would be disastrous.
As I mentioned earlier, and you put it in your book, these Alaskan populations, these native populations, are living lives very close to the lives that their ancestors lived 2,000, 3,000 years ago. But they have taken advantage and adopted some modern customs. They have snowmobiles. They have four-wheelers and trucks and high-powered rifles and motorboats, as well as satellite television and computers, much of which require the kind of energy that we generate now through fossil fuels to run. That would lead some people to say that these folks are adapting to the problem, and further, that they have adapted themselves to modern necessities that are causing the problem. Why should we be concerned that they won't be able to hunt whales or caribou anymore? Why should we care? Because they'll be able to go to their local grocery store and buy whatever they need.
Well, that presumes that you're going to allow cultures to be basically destroyed, what we refer to as in social science as ethnocide. And so I don't think that's a good idea to wipe out cultures as we go just because of our need to have gas for our Bronimobile. I drive a car. You drive a car. Our cars are probably gasoline.
But so do they.
And so do they. Well, they have no roads up there. But they do drive four-wheelers. They have diesel for their motorboats. I mean, they definitely take advantage of this. For Barrow, what they say is that we've got all this cheap gas up here. They've got a gas supply just a few miles away, a natural gas supply. Of course, there are other places that don't. But, I mean, just like us, I mean, we're going to drive to Charlotte, too, at least some of us. And we're using gas to go down there to tell people that fossil fuels, including gasoline, is hurting us. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line, we've got to make the move.
You've already mentioned one of the consequences that we really have to think hard and long about, Robin, is rising sea level. And, of course, the other thing we have to worry about is the dramatic change in the intensity of storms. Just witness what happened up in New York City with that Hurricane Sandy a couple of months ago. And the weather seems to be becoming wilder everywhere. So what do we do about rising sea levels, which inevitably will impact us? When they talk about it going up an inch, maybe 2 inches, what does that really mean?
Well, it means one of the things you need to be thinking about and planning for is how you develop and redevelop the coastal areas, not just in North Carolina, but all along the eastern seaboard. And one of the questions that's coming up after Hurricane Sandy is whether all of those areas can and should be rebuilt. or whether some number of those structures are in areas that are so vulnerable it's really not feasible to rebuild. So there are decisions you have to make immediately after storms if you have storm destruction about whether it's really possible to rebuild in the same location. You've got planning decisions that need to be made that are somewhat longer term about where structures go and where they can be rebuilt if they're damaged or destroyed.
Is rising sea level something that they've had to face in Alaska?
Yes, they have, as a matter of fact, because places like Point Hope, Alaska, to a lesser degree Barrow, a place called Shishmaref, all those are on the north or northwestern coast of Alaska, up in the Arctic. And Shishmaref had to be moved. Well, actually, Point Hope has moved once, and they're about to have to move again. And interestingly, it's not necessarily because water is coming from melting glaciers and raising the level. It's just that around that temperature that water expands as it warms. And that has caused probably the most of the damage right now.
So
but
okay.
let me just make one more point.
Sure.
If we should melt the glaciers on Greenland, which are on land, doesn't matter too much about ice melting at sea because it's not going to change the level of the water. But if you bring more water down in from the melting glaciers and also on Antarctica, then you're talking about sea level changes on the order of 20 to 40 feet. So it won't take too many bright scientists to figure out that that's going to be a tremendous problem.
And that would inundate cities, coastal cities, inundate them
yes.
all over the world.
Yes.
At the same time that we're talking about an increase in the height of salt water, we're experiencing incredible drought, at least in this part of the world we are and have for several years. And I think the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just released a prognosis for this summer and said that once again it would be a very, very, very dry summer in the southwest part of the United States where they've gotten very little rain for the last several years. That brings into question the topic of water resources. And in North Carolina, Robin, we've already faced some problems with water resources, not just because of the drought, but because of increasing population. By 2050, I believe it is, there won't be enough water to go around.
Well, it's going to vary a lot from one part of the state to another. We have gotten better at water conservation because of the droughts in 2002 and 2007. So we've made some progress in making water systems more efficient, but there's a lot more work to be done on that. And you're right, it's a real real challenge with most of the population growth in the state happening in areas that are not necessarily the areas with the most water supply.
Are people working toward that in Raleigh that you know of, or is there still resistance to doing that because, A, it costs money and money is tight, or, B, there is not the political will because there are too many deniers out there saying this is not really going to be a problem, we're just wasting good money, or, C, there's nothing we can do about this because we have nothing to do with it, so therefore we just sit back and throw our hands up. Do you see any of that going on? Or do you see people working hard on these problems?
Well, you know, I think there are people who are working hard on these problems and trying to think ahead. I know the state's Coastal Resources Commission has been grappling with, how to plan for sea level rise for several years now and have done a couple of reports on that. As I said earlier in the General Assembly, the tide seems to be going the other way. There's more skepticism about climate change and more skepticism about doing anything. On the other hand, I think even among the climate change skeptics, there's a lot of concern about water supply. And so, you know, there are things that can be done without forcing people to announce that they're a believer in climate change. A lot of things that can be done on water conservation and water supply that need to be done for a variety of reasons. And I do think there's interest in that, and that cuts across political lines, and there's an understanding that the state's got to grapple with its water supply issues.
I only have a few minutes left here, but I wanted to go back to Duke Energy because we know that they generate electricity relatively inexpensively in terms of what we pay in North Carolina versus the rest of the country, but they do it through water, they do it through coal, they do it through natural gas, they do it through nuclear power, and they do a little, I think, solar, but not in this part of the country, and a little wind perhaps, but not in this part of the country. They want to build more energy fired. More coal-fired plants. They call it clean coal, which is a misnomer. There's no such thing. But what is their alternative? Is the time horizon of building a new clean coal plant the same as putting lots of windmills out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean? Who knows the answer to that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. If you build more nuclear plants and more coal plants, you're going to use a heck of a lot more water. They are very water intensive, and they're sucking our rivers and lakes dry. So that's just the opposite direction if you're concerned about water. The little things that Robin's talking about in terms of improvements, water conservation is very important. The universities have gone to that now in many cases. That's important. But it pales by comparison to what Duke and Progress plan with building more nukes and coal.
This may be a loaded question for somebody who left the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources when Governor McCrory came into office, but there are some who believe that his appointment of John, I'm not sure how to say his last name, John Scavarla?
Right.
To run that department, to be an ominous sign, because he's been described as a science skeptic. What's your take on that? And I only have 30 seconds.
I can't say anything intelligent about that. I don't know Mr. Scavarla. I only know what I've read in the newspapers. And he's made some statements that sounded somewhat skeptical, but I can't speak to that, really.
If you want to know what's happening with climate change and how it's impacting humans already, you need to pick up a copy of Dr. Harvard Ayer's book, Arctic Gardens, Voices from an Abundant Land. He's a professor emeritus of anthropology at Appalachian State University. And Robin Smith joined us by phone, environmental attorney and a former assistant secretary for the environment at the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks.